from respiratory therapist to ninja. Yes, I am bringing you today a real life ninja, Cheryl Ilove. But before she became a ninja, she was a respiratory therapist and critical care specialist in the cardiac care unit. After spending almost 20 years in the field, then she earned her master's degree in physical therapy and then spent an additional 18 years in private practice. But then after all that, she decides, hey, I'm going to turn into a ninja. Now, she calls it a second degree black belt in an ancient Japanese martial art called Ninpo Tai Jiu-Jitsu, but we know that she's a ninja. We'll just call her a ninja. Cheryl and I have become fast friends. This is part of the fun about having a podcast is you get to meet so many interesting people. So I present to you my conversation with Cheryl Ilove.
Welcome to the Heart Chamber, hope, inspiration, and healing, conversations on open heart surgery. I am your host, Boots Knighton. If you are a heart patient, a caregiver, a healthcare provider, a healer, or are just looking for open-hearted living, this podcast is for you. To make sure you are in rhythm with the Heart Chamber, be sure to subscribe or follow wherever you are listening to this episode. While you are listening today, think of someone who may appreciate this information. The number one way people learn about a podcast is through a friend. Don't you want to be the reason someone you know gained this heartfelt information? And if you haven't already, follow me on Instagram, two different places, at boots.knighton or at the Heart Chamber Podcast. You can also find me on LinkedIn as well as Facebook. But enough with the directions. Without further delay, let's get to this week's episode. Cheryl Ilove, thank you so much for your willingness to come on to the Heart Chamber Podcast and share your experience as a respiratory therapist, now turned ninja. I was so lucky to meet you through your podcast, and there's so many pleasant surprises I've experienced since I decided to embark on this journey. One of them is meeting all these people around the United States and the world, and you are just a treasure. So thanks again for saying yes today. And, you know, listeners, I'll have all the ways you can find Cheryl. She's written books. She's a complete and total badass. And it is really, really incredible to hear her entire story. But for today, we're going to focus in on the respiratory therapy part because we heart patients more than likely will be intubated during our surgeries. And I have been trying to find someone like Cheryl for a while to explain to us what this whole process is, what it's about. And so Cheryl, thank you so much again for your generosity and spending some time with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, Boots. I really appreciate it. I just love talking to you.
Well, walk us through how you even got into this job, this career. I mean, there's all these different careers out there in the world. Why respiratory therapy?
Oh, it's a crazy story, but actually I am number three out of five children. I have four sisters. And when my mother had three little girls in 4 years, my two older sisters and myself. So we grew up, you know, very, very close in age. Mm-hmm. And my dad was Eastern European. He's an immigrant, or was an immigrant. And, you know, my mother started talking. She never went to college. She finished high school. But back in the day, I'm a baby boomer. So my mom wanted all of us, the three of us, to go to college. And my dad said, no, they don't need to go to college. They're girls. They're just going to get married and have children. And my mother was just devastated. But she kept pushing it. And one day he came home from work and he says, you know what? I think they should go to college. And she says, it was thrilled and said, well, what changed your mind? And he said, well, just in case they end up with, I'll just say a loser, but he used another word, you know, who was a real jerk. then they would be able to take care of themselves because they would have an education. She didn't care. Okay, good enough. That's good enough for her. And then she was trying to figure out, well, what are they going to do with a college education? And it was like, they have to go into either teaching or nursing, because those were the only two professions my mother knew about that were feminine professions, and also professions where once we got married and started having children, that we would be able to work part-time, so still have somewhat of a career. Interestingly enough, out of the three of us, one is a teacher. She's still teaching. One went into med tech, and I ended up in respiratory therapy. And how I ended up in RT, back then in the day, it was actually called inhalation therapy. That's how long ago it was, until finally they realized, oh, well, you exhale too. So it's the respiratory system, and that it ended up being respiratory therapy. But my sister, the one who was going to college to be a med tech, was just a year older than me. And I followed in her footsteps. I did everything that she did. And she came home one time and looked at my mother and said, Mom, Cheryl is never going to be able to make it as a med tech. She cannot do this curriculum. It is too hard. She's not smart enough. But there's this new profession called inhalation therapy, and one of my friends says it's not nearly as difficult as med tech. So that's how I ended up in the respiratory therapy program. So our program was a 4-year program, 2 years at the local college. So I was living on campus, but 2 years there. And then we spent 2 years at this huge teaching hospital in the middle of Pittsburgh. So I did not see my first patient until my junior year of college. I had no idea what I was getting into. I think my mother and my sister probably thought that respiratory therapy or inhalation therapy, I would just go around handing out oxygen masks, kind of like the flight attendants on, you know, an airplane. So there I was, 19 years old, in critical care, going, I did not sign up for this. I have no idea what I'm doing. Some of my classmates, there were only 20 of us that ended up going down to the hospital, and some of them had a little bit of experience in RT, but mostly just giving respiratory treatments, the breathing treatments. So none of us were really quite prepared, you know, for critical care, the ventilators, the whole shebang, and we clung to each other desperately and, you know, kind of like went through this process together. So when I realized what I was supposed to be doing, and I was going to be in charge of life support equipment, plus all of some of the other unpleasant things, I couldn't go to my parents and say, hey, changed my mind. I don't want to do this, because they already invested 2 years into my education. And the prereqs that I had done my first 2 years, the only other way I could use them would be to go into nursing, and that was just as bad. So I just stuck it out. And I was a respiratory therapist for a little over 17 years.
Wow. I'm just processing all that for you, because I'm just thinking the amount of trauma you were exposed to at such a young age. And I mean, no one at 19 years old has the skills to process that. That's a lot. But you stayed in it for 17 years. Like, eventually you probably got to a point where you could make your own grown-up decisions, as my husband and I like to say. What kept you in it for as long as you stayed?
Well, there was definitely a period of adjustment, and there was a lot of trauma. And thank goodness my classmates and I, you know, we would, like I said, cling together. And so we would support each other doing some of these things that we experienced. And we also, there was a local bar right around the corner. So we were there a lot. And that's kind of how we, you know, you adapt and you learn. And there's something about cardiopulmonary. It was so fascinating. And, you know, I was never a really good student growing up. I couldn't care less. I mean, I made fairly good grades, enough to get by, but I was always the kid looking outside, out the window, wanting to be doing something else, wanting to do something fun, something exciting. And so I never was that interested. But by the time I got to that third year of college, so we were doing our clinical work along with more advanced book work and didactic work, it was absolutely fascinating. I mean, I made the dean's list for the first time and ever shocked my parents, but I loved the cardiopulmonary system. And then I got used to, you know, what I call the blood and guts, and used to being on the floor and working with people. I'm a people person, so I really liked being able to comfort people, especially when they were scared, and they were always scared. I was scared too, but I couldn't, you know, let them see that. So I really enjoyed it and ended up being, you know, a supervisor once I moved to Denver. was in a management position, became a critical care specialist as well as a clinical instructor.
That's quite the metamorphosis, considering you weren't smart enough to be a nurse. Mm-hmm. And I'm putting that in air quotes for the, right? Mm-hmm. So that is an incredible story in and of itself, worthy of its own episode. Just, it's amazing how we humans can grow and change and evolve and turn a really, I dare say, toxic situation into something really beautiful, profound, and impactful. So I applaud you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. And I got an awful lot of joy. I got a lot of satisfaction being the one as a respiratory therapist, even in the emergency room. I was always the one at the patient's head because, you know, airway, and being able to talk to them and keep them calm and to be able to give them some comfort in a very scary time.
Well, let's switch to the technical side for all of us heart patients then. Thanks for the backstory. I think backstories are so important. Mm-hmm. As a heart patient who has now, you know, been through heart surgery and extubated, no thanks. It was my least favorite part of the entire experience, as if I had any favorite parts. I had you on to help us understand this whole process. So can you take us to a 20-minute medical school of just the whole picture, the process, what to experience, what to expect as a heart patient?
It's been quite a few years since I had done it, but let me take you all the way back to, because I'm not sure how they do it now, but even up to the point when I was leaving respiratory therapy and going to a different field, physical therapy, but we would do pre-op. So we would go and we would talk to the patients the day before their surgery. We would explain to them every single step of the way what was going to happen. Go into the OR, you know, they'll put you to sleep. They will put you. And by this time, they've already heard about the heart-lung machine. And, you know, then you'd have the ventilator in the OR. So that's breathing for you. Because basically, you're in a state of, I don't want to say coma, but it's almost like a pseudo-death state, which is completely under control with your medical team, the surgical team. They're usually fantastic. So once the surgery is completed, you know, you're all sutured back up and you go to the recovery room. You'll go to the recovery room on a ventilator. Again, controlled situation. You have people taking care of the anesthesiology team will be checking on you, making sure everything is fine. And then as soon as you are stable enough, then they send you to the intensive care unit or cardiac care unit or, you know, the surgical, cardiac surgical care unit. So there you are. And thank goodness things have changed. In the old days when I was just getting started, you were in like this big bay with all these other patients.
Like a stadium.
Pretty much. I mean, you're in, you know, there's like 9 beds, just maybe a little curtain between you and the person beside you. So at least now you're in a private room. And it is really kind of scary because you cannot talk because you've got the tube in your throat. And, you know, a lot of times you're restrained so you don't accidentally start pulling at the tube or any of the other things that you're hooked up to. You're being monitored constantly. And even if there isn't a nurse or a respiratory therapist or a physician in the room with you, we are constantly monitoring you from all of the equipment at the nurse's station. If something, even a very small, slight abnormality, alarms go off, the team comes running. So you're never really alone, even though it might feel like that.
Can I interrupt and ask a question? What abnormalities could come up?
Oh, let's say if the ventilator starts alarming, maybe if, you know, you maybe start coughing a little bit, something so small as you start to twitch. And we're watching that on the monitors. And constantly your heart monitor is being, you know, recorded and shown at the nurse's station. So one time I was just grabbing a patient's chart and I went to flip through it and I happened to look at the monitor and I said to the nurse, is this a normal EKG? It doesn't look like one. And it wasn't a heart patient, but it was just the critical care. And of course, you know, we all went running and the patient was fine. So, you know, your team is not leaving you alone. They are constantly looking and watching. Wow. So just wanted to, you know, reassure your listeners that you are being watched, even though you don't know it.
Let's go to the very basics here.
Sure.
What is the point of having a tube down one's throat? Why did I have to have a tube down my throat? I know why, but for the listener, like the basic ABCs of this.
For the ventilator, because you have received so much medication, you have undergone, as you said before, a serious traumatic surgery. And think about it, somebody was touching your heart, and that's a pretty serious thing. And you don't just wake up like you would if it was a tonsillectomy or a bunionectomy. It takes time, and it takes time for your heart to recover from that. It takes time for your heart and your lungs to get working again in an efficient manner on their own. And that's what the ventilator is for, is to make sure that you're being oxygenated. So we want to make sure that, you know, you're getting the appropriate amount of oxygen. It is being delivered to your tissues appropriately. You constantly have that little pulse oximeter. And thank God they came up with a pulse oximeter, because otherwise we would just be taking blood gases, which was pretty brutal. Everything is being monitored. And you're in such a deep sleep at this point. So as you are starting to become a little bit more awake, a little bit more aware, and we're checking your vital signs, then we start to do what we call, I don't want to say pulmonary functions, but we're starting to see what you can do spontaneously on your own. So we have different flow meters. Again, I haven't done it in many years, so things may have changed, but we're testing to see, okay, if you can breathe on your own. So again, the respiratory therapist is there the entire time talking you through it. Okay, you know, we're just going to see now. In the old days, we used those meters. I think now you can do it through the ventilator. You know, we're going to have you breathe on your own. I'm with you. And just see, they're measuring the amount of air that the patient can inhale and exhale. And of course, we're, again, still monitoring the oxygen levels. And then we have them take the biggest deep breath they can and blow it out. And it's like, okay, I think we're ready to be extubated. And then, of course, you know, we connect with either the surgeon or the anesthesiologist, and then they give the order to go ahead and extubate.
I'm remembering all this. I remember waking up and having my arms attached to the railings, and that was so shocking. And I had the meeting the day before with the RT, and she walked me through the whole thing. But no amount of pre-meetings can really set you up for a calm experience.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I mean, I've woke up from anesthesia before, and just the first thing I did, I mean, I was trying to pop out of bed and just, you know, basically lay on top of me, you know, because I woke up fighting. And it is, I think, not an abnormal reaction. And you're right. You can hear this all day long, you know, oh, and just, you know, trust us and, you know, we'll talk to you. And it's like, screw that.
You know, my surgeon, bless his heart, he was so patient with me because I was like flipping him off. Well, I knew I had to throw up. I immediately was sick to my stomach, and I had this tube down my throat. And the only way I could get their attention was I was like, you know, strapped to the bed, and I'm like flipping them off like this. And my husband, the nurses, and the surgeon was right there. And it was like the only way that I could think of to let them know that I was in a world of trouble. Wow. And he was like, don't worry about it. My feelings aren't hurt. He said the number one thing that humans need to do to stay alive is breathe. And you knew that you were about to throw up and your breathing was compromised. He's like, I get it. So,
But and technically, really, I'm getting into the respiratory therapy head that still is in there very, very deep. Technically, you would still be breathing around throwing up.
Okay.
Because the tube was there. The tube actually has a balloon around it.
Oh.
So there's like a we call it the cuff. So even if you threw up, there would be no chance of you aspirating.
Because no one ever told me that.
Yeah.
You were the first person to tell me this.
Can you believe that? So yeah, so if you have to throw up, I mean, and throwing up is the most unpleasant thing I think that a body could do, you would be fine. And that cuff is around, you know, your trachea, keeping it sealed again so the vomit would not go down, and you would still be getting the same amount of air exchange. It's just throwing up is so unpleasant anyway. Throwing up with an endotracheal tube in place, I think would be absolutely horrific and terrifying.
Wow. Well, then I proceeded to throw up 25 times after I was extubated, though. So at least I had that going for me.
Right? Jeez. It's those little things that get you through. Small blessings.
I need to take a side trip with you.
Sure.
You mentioned when the patient is under, you said almost like a coma-like state, near death.
Mm-hmm.
So I had someone ask me the other day, and this is a question I've just not been able to answer, and I'm not even sure you can, but I was being interviewed on another podcast, and the fellas asked me if I died, if I was dead.
Boy, that's a really interesting question, because yes and no. Physiologically, you know, you are being kept alive. Your brain is still functioning.
Right. Because that's what signifies death, is when the brain is no longer being oxygenated, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Your heart has been stopped. So you had no heartbeat. And that's the function of the heart-lung machine, because the blood is being shunted from your body into this machine, which takes care of the oxygenation, removing the carbon dioxide, you know, to keeping the blood clear, functioning the way it should be. So, you know, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no.
How about in the ways, yes? What ways was I dead?
You know, that's a really tough one that I cannot answer, because what is the definition of death? I would say that you were taken to the edge of death. Does that help?
I can't remember exactly how I answered the question, and I know other heart patients have this question. I will say I've changed so dramatically as a soul and as a human body since my heart surgery that surely something shifted, right? Like another woman I just interviewed, Laura Horweg, who had open heart surgery, and she's an intuitive. So it was a really fascinating interview. Ooh. And she explained just how, like, our heart chakra, our energetic center is opened up. And it's just this question I continue to sit with, just because I'm just one of those minds where I need to know. Yeah.
When you put it that way, I would have to say that yes, energetically you were dead from that kind of a standpoint.
And I would say that feels correct to me. Like, it feels like, yeah. And especially because for many weeks after my heart surgery, I was very disassociated. And it was like my soul was just kind of following me from behind, trying to figure out, like, so we are alive. Oh, okay. So.
Again, I mean, your heart energy is so strong. And your spirit, you know, and I talk about spirit from like the martial arts aspect of it, because I never really understood it the way I do now. But it is actually, you know, I'm not even sure if there's a difference between spirit and soul. I'm still kind of going back and forth with that.
Yeah, same. It's like a plate of spaghetti that I threw up against the wall. I'm trying to understand it all. I know I've radically accepted now that I may never know. And I'm kind of okay with it. I'm just such a scientific mind. The death thing is still with me.
Yeah. I'm more scientific the way you are. I'm more, you know, okay, just the facts. I don't do woo-woo. It, you know, took me a very long time to even accept a lot of these alternative, you know, modalities. And when I did, it was like, oh, there really is something here.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting back on track. So it's time to extubate. My husband, thankfully, took so many pictures of this whole experience. And so definitely wasn't my best look that day. The pictures show just all these different, like, tubes and wires. I mean, it wasn't just the tube coming out of my mouth.
Correct.
I did not get any coaching on that. And so I remember it was really overwhelming to see all the different things coming out of my body. Can you walk us through that?
So above and beyond the endotracheal tube.
Yep.
Wow. You've got a ton of different IVs going in you. You've got a lot of different, you know, needles in you. The monitoring devices. It's been so long, I'm having a hard time even remembering. But there is a ton of hardware involved in this, because you do have, it's not just the ventilator, it's the ventilator, it's, you know, the EKG machine, it's the oxygenation that we're monitoring. We're monitoring every single thing on you. I think that if anybody would see this prior to surgery, it would really freak them out, or it might reassure them of, look, this is how closely we are watching every single body function. You know, you got a catheter in to, you know, drain your urine. You know,
there's
all these things that you're really not even prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
And even like you said, intellectually, if somebody explains this to you, it can't prepare you. When I was a brand new respiratory therapist, and now you have to imagine, even still, I was a student, heart surgery was not nearly as effective, efficient, and successful. Now, you know, I mean, people would be in the hospital for like 2 weeks at least.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're in and out fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And
that part is just miraculous to me.
It's incredible. So if only, you know, medicine just keeps on, the technology keeps on improving, getting better and better. So one of these days, you know, hopefully we'll be able to do open heart surgery without as much of all of those tubes and invasion of your body. But for right now, it's just, that's what helps keep you alive.
Or maybe we won't have to have open heart surgery at all.
That would be the best.
It would be. It would be phenomenal. I'm, you know, I still have a bicuspid valve, and I'm hoping by the time that thing, if it needs replaced, that it won't have to be another open heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have two people that I know very well, who, one's a neighbor of mine who's in his 80s, mid-80s at least, and had an aortic valve repair. And we're talking to his wife, you know, walking the dog. Hey, how's he doing? Oh, great. You know, took him home the same day. I'm going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait, wait, what?
The same day.
And they went in through the femoral artery.
Yep.
Pretty sure that's how they did it. All the way up, and were able to replace it. I mean, the surgery took like boom, boom, boom. It was so fast. And it's just stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fine.
It's amazing, like, what we are really excelling at as a species right now and what really needs work at the same time. But
right? I mean, the dichotomy is just incredible.
It's like we're still having wars because that, you know, solves things. Not.
Yeah.
But we're going to be able to go through your femoral artery and replace your a valve, right?
Right. So and other parts of medicine are still pretty, you know, archaic.
Yeah.
But again, we'll just take a little wire and go up that femoral artery and replace a valve,
right,
and you're going to be home in time for dinner.
Yeah, but yet we're still going to have our boobs squeezed once a year to check for cancer. So yes, all these different wires. I really like how you said, I'm going to tweak your words a little bit. I like the thought of, instead of being freaked out by all these different wires and needles and tubes and everything, let's just be reassured.
Be comforted by it.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's such a great reframe. I just love that so much.
Mm-hmm. And remember, your medical team really cares about you. At least most of them do. Our happiest moment is when our patients leave the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's very exciting
alive
for us. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they're walking out or well in the wheelchair. Yeah. That's why I stuck with it for so long.
And so eventually you made the decision to leave.
I did, mostly because I wanted to challenge myself a little bit more. I wanted to get further my education. I wanted to get a master's in something. And fool that I was, it had to be something medical. I don't know why I thought that. But I ended up going into physical therapy. And the main reason why I left respiratory therapy was because I was losing my edge. And I knew it. And I couldn't function the way I could before, you know, reflexively just, you know, do everything I had and then deal with my emotions later. I couldn't do it anymore. And it was like, I woke up one day and it was like, I can't do this. Cause it's not just the cleanliness of the heart patient. It's all the other things that you have to deal with through the emergency room, you know, the pediatrics, the deaths, the dying. And I just thought that going into a PT would be a lot more life-affirming. I was wrong. Ended up opening my own practice because I didn't like PT anymore. You know, it was just not for me at that point. So, you know, I had a nice career in respiratory, a lovely career. I had a really good one in physical therapy, had my own office for almost 20 years, and closed my office, and now I just podcast, I write books, you know, I beat people up at the dojo, and that's my life.
From respiratory therapist to physical therapist to ninja.
Yeah. Who knew?
You just keep showing up.
And I don't know any other way.
Do the next right thing.
Sometimes it doesn't seem like the right thing, but it always works out.
I just want to keep harping on RT because that was the point. Tell us one of your most memorable moments and one of your hardest moments.
Gosh, the memorable moments.
In 2 minutes.
Moments.
It's kind of rapid fire.
All right. I would have to say one of my most memorable moments was I was a student. A classmate of mine and myself had the run of the ER, the ER for the day. You know, it's like, you know, hang out the ER so you can see things and learn things. And nothing was happening. This was that Pittsburgh hospital. It's like, yeah, let's just go to lunch. And as we're leaving, one of the ER docs came up and says, hey, you might want to hang around because we got some guy coming in who had his hand crushed between a car. You know, it was a snowy day in Pittsburgh. Isn't it always? And it's like, oh, yeah, it'd be nice to see that, you know, because he says a lot of times it's like looking at the inside of an anatomy book. So we hung out and they brought the patient in and he lifted his head and said, hi, Cheryl. And it was like, holy crap. He was somebody that I knew from the local mall in my hometown. He, you know, worked there and I used to buy fabric from him. So to realize that, what is it, 6 degrees of separation or whatever they say, mm-hmm. and how close it is. And it's like, I'm going to be running into people I know. Mm-hmm. And I think the hardest one, still gives me chills. It was the day that I was like, I'm done. Mm-hmm. And that was a baby that they had brought in through the ER. This was deep, obviously, at the end of my career. And it was a house fire.
Oh.
And apparently, I was working on the baby, and there was another toddler or young child in another room in the ER. And it was that knowledge and understanding that apparently the parents went out to dinner and left with a babysitter, and one of the kids was a special needs who was on oxygen, and somebody had left a lighter, and one of the kids started playing with it, and that was it. And it's like, you know, an adult loses their focus for a nanosecond, and this is what happens.
Yep.
And it was like, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Yeah, that would have probably ended it for me.
Mm-hmm. I was done.
The healthcare system, I think, is at such an inflection point. And I hope that this podcast can get into the ears of all healthcare providers too. And like, we have these conversations with folks like yourself. I mean, I know you're not in it now, but I mean, you put in a lot of time, you saw a lot, and my heart and my hat goes off to all healthcare providers who can be there in we patients, all of us mm-hmm. patients' hardest moments. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all have a soul and we all care deeply. It's a lot to ask of our nervous systems day in and day out.
It really is. And a lot of those images, they're very vivid, even though it's been a very long time. I remember a lot of the names mm-hmm. still. Mm-hmm. I remember some of the family still. So, you know, and you learn to deal with it. But what really bothered me and still does is that we were given absolutely no support. Nobody thought, hey, maybe our team needs a little bit of TLC. Maybe they need some debriefing. There was only one incident when that did happen. So, yeah, it's really tough. It's really tough. You build incredible relationships with your coworkers, good and bad.
Yeah. I have just loved this conversation with you. It's shed more light on my surgical experience. I know it's going to help so many other patients and their caregivers and medical teams. Thank you for being you, for showing up every day and doing the next right thing.
Thank you so much for having me, Boots. I just love talking to you. Mm-hmm. You're just amazing. And, you know, so the listeners know I do have a podcast, and Boots was on my show. And, oh my gosh, it still hasn't aired yet, but I will let you know when it does. And I think you're going to love the title.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You want to reveal it now?
I don't even remember it right now. I will tell you. It's a very busy place in my head right now.
Well, and y'all, I will, like I said, I'm going to link Cheryl's show, her website, everything in the notes. So thank you so much again. And you're such a blessing.
Oh, thank you. And so are you. I'm so grateful I got to meet you.
Thank you for sharing a few heartbeats of your day with me today. Please be sure to follow or subscribe to this podcast wherever you are listening. Share with a friend who will value what we discussed. Go to either Apple Podcasts and write us a review, or mark those stars on Spotify. I read these, and your feedback is so encouraging, and it also helps others find this podcast. Also, please feel free to drop me a note at boots@theheartchamberpodcast.com.
I truly want to know how you're doing and if this podcast has been a source of hope, inspiration, and healing for you. Again, I am your host, Boots Knighton, and thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday for another episode of The Heart Chamber.